It's the Dipshit Files, episode 98, last show of the season.
Mm-hmm.
Until we come back in May, I'm Mr. Scriptkeeper.
And I'm Mrs. Scriptkeeper.
And we got a fucking terrible son of a bitch.
Yes, we do.
A true dipshit.
Yeah, we do.
Who like to talk like the Cookie Monster?
Yeah, this guy's a little odd.
So we're calling this one the Cookie Monster of Philadelphia, because he deserves that.
Yes.
Maybe not, I don't know. But it's a serial killer.
Yeah.
True crime.
True crime episode, yes.
Big nasty file. Let's look at it. All right, before we get to this show, cards. Nope, this week it's coffee. And cards. May 6th, for patrons only, we will be releasing Scat Roast, our very own coffee with prizes inside. Two of them. A Scat card or Scat pack. We're still figuring out the card exactly how it's going to be, but it might be a PSA graded 10 Victor Wembanyama. You don't know.
What?
I don't know. But May 7th, it will be available to everyone, and we'll be running it from then on.
Yeah.
Scat Roast.
Yes.
With prizes in fucking side. And it's good coffee, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, it is very good coffee.
That was like, that was your part of the project.
And well, I'm not gonna put coffee out there that tastes like shit.
I'm not gonna put out things without toys. All right, that's enough. But May 6th, May 7th, look for that, and we hope you'll join us. So help support our podcast while with coffee.
With coffee.
I can't talk today. Let's get to the show.
All right.
And now the Dipshit Files presents the Cookie Monster of Philadelphia.
Between 1985 and 1989, investigators in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, were called into three separate cases of serial murder.
Cookie?
That's a lot for one city. However, the 1980s had seen an increase in serial murders across the country.
Cookie.
Especially those that involved uniquely gruesome details.
And cookies.
From the Night Stalker, Richard Ramirez, with his flair for Satanism, to Robert Bredella's torture of imprisoned men, the 1980s seemed to inspire killers to act out their worst fantasies. Mm. Someone dubbed the Frankfurt Slasher stabbed seven people to death in a Philadelphia neighborhood while the police learned from an escaping victim about Gary Hynek, who was holding female prisoners in the basement of his house on North Marshall Street. One had died from hanging in chains, and one had been killed. The police found three more intended victims in the house, chained up and starving.
Just made me think about like a whole street filled with serial killers with people in their basement.
Oh, hey, Bob. Nice night, huh?
Yeah.
How's the missus?
I'm wearing her skin.
Oh, that's right. She's dead as fuck.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say thanks for recommending that no questions asked construction guy.
He's my cousin.
I was having a hell of a time keeping people I was going to murder in my basement from getting out.
It happens.
It just kept happening, you know, until your cousin.
Glad I could help.
Incidentally, I'm holding your cousin prisoner in my basement.
Nice.
Well, who you got? Well, one of them got away. Thanks for bringing them back for me.
It's just crazy.
Yeah.
So Hynek had used them as sex slaves and was planning to add even more. After his arrest, he admitted to eating pieces of one victim and feeding parts to his captives.
Okay.
Then
this doesn't taste like pork chops at all.
Then Leonard Christopher was arrested and convicted of the Frankfurt area murders. Although there was an eighth woman that was murdered in a similar way while he was in prison, so his conviction became controversial. One set of witnesses had seen a white man with some of the victims, but others stood by their identification of Christopher. He'd worked in the fish market where the seventh woman was found dead, had many inconsistencies to his story, and was seen with a victim and with a knife, and had been found with spots of blood on his clothing.
He also had a custom t-shirt made that said, "I killed these people."
Right.
It was really pretty obvious.
So while all this was happening, on a ridiculously hot August day in 1987, the police were called to a two-room apartment in a rundown brick row house in North Philadelphia. The tenant of 4 years, a man named Harrison Marty Graham, who was known to talk like the Cookie Monster from Sesame Street, had been evicted at noon that day due to a terrible odor emanating from his apartment.
Not Cookie.
Before leaving, he nailed the door shut to one of the rooms and said, "I'll be back for the rest of my stuff."
That's a different way to handle your landlord.
Right?
Landlord, you do what I tell you, motherfucker.
I'll be back.
Don't touch my cookies.
Landlord Nathaniel Choice had sent his son and his nephew to take care of this business, and when they found their access to this room had been blocked, they peeked through the keyhole.
Yeah.
And that's when they called the police. It was August 9th, a Sunday afternoon that threatened to saturate the already humid air with a rain shower. An officer familiar with the area from numerous drug busts arrived at 1631 North 19th Street near Cecil B. Moore Avenue.
And immediately said, "I'm getting too old for this shit."
Where many buildings along that block had been boarded up and abandoned.
And so are these buildings.
Just that week, the police had arrested someone in the same block for dealing in R&Ts, which are Ritalin and Toluene, a combination of a stimulant and a painkiller that offered a cheap high. Although the building at 1631 looked deserted with broken windows and a missing front door, families did live in several of the apartments. Officer Pete Scalatino walked up to the third floor. He could smell the odor of death even before he entered the place, so he'd already assumed he'd find a dead body.
Right.
He walked into the room of the apartment and saw waist-high piles of trash everywhere.
Okay. That could contribute to the smell as
right,
well.
Right, right. On a kitchen wall was the drawing of a naked woman with an aggressively written expletive scrawled next to it and a smear of what looked like dried blood left by the dragging of two fingers across the paper.
I'd say he was living the good life.
Yikes. Yeah. Clearly, someone had once had a dog or two in there, as hardened
Boopies.
Animal excrement on the floor contributed to the stench.
I'll just leave that there until it gets hard.
Ugh.
That'll be fine.
The two men who'd made the call told the police officer to look through the keyhole. So he bent down near the door that had the name Marty painted across it to have a look. He saw a black woman's naked legs. She remained way too still, so he assumed that this was the source of the offensive stench.
Also the poop.
Officer Scalatino knocked and announced himself, but the figure still didn't move. Charles Johnson, an investigator with the medical examiner's office, joined the officer.
And he said, "I'm also too old for this shit."
His black van outside quickly drew the attention of neighbors who gathered around, talking to one another, trying to guess what was happening inside.
They were all playing Name That Smell.
Oh, God.
I think he just lets his dog shit in there. I'm voting dog.
I got 100 says it's rotten food. He never takes out the garbage.
Well, he's on drugs all the time.
I think he's got dead bodies in there.
Oh, Judy going hard with the dead bodies.
Have you considered the possibility that he started his own privately owned dump?
He wouldn't do that.
In his apartment?
I've seen it done.
I'm seeing dead bodies.
I've got mounds of animal shit.
I think he owned a little dump.
Scalatino and Johnson pried open the door to get into the second room. The odor nearly overwhelmed them, so they were forced to wear masks.
Whoever had the money on dump.
The two men found that this room was, too, piled high with trash, but not so much that they couldn't see the victim. The nude female they'd spotted through the keyhole was indeed deceased.
Ah, Judy was right.
She lay on a mattress on the floor next to a television set and was surrounded by piles of trash. She'd been dead for some time, as she was discolored and bloated.
Ugh.
Her limbs askew from the way her body was decomposing.
I mean, friends are family, yes,
but next to the mattress on the floor was another female, also bloated.
Oh, boy.
She was wearing a denim miniskirt and a light-colored shirt with the words Portois and a red nose printed on it.
Portois. Does that mean 4-3?
Portois. I think so. Portois.
Oh, fucking me.
For three noses.
It's a basketball thing. For three.
The men put yellow crane seed tape up around the building and in the hallway. Then they called for backup. There was no electricity and most of the windows had been boarded up, so in the dark room, they needed some extra lights. While drug overdoses were common in this area, they could have simply died in the building and been dumped here. Scalatino called in a homicide detective, James Hansen, who had just led the Heineck investigation. Ambiguous scenes such as this one required him to assume murder first. It wasn't that unusual to find homeless people crawling into these places, or even the elderly who had no one to care for them. Finally, just giving up the ghost and hoping that someone would care for their remains. Even still, within the filth and the trash, roaches and fleas, syringes and spoons, and glass jars filled with yellow liquid.
Pee-pee?
It seemed as though there had to be more to this overpowering stench than a dead body.
Pee-pee.
Old newspapers and magazines were piled high along with mattresses and smelly blankets, and there were old, moldy dog feces in many places. Flies were everywhere.
I used to work at a pet store, right? A lot of you guys know that. I walked into a lot of homes like that.
Ugh.
Cats and dogs. I've told the story of the cats, but lots of dogs, too, where it's like, really?
Awful.
And they're like, yeah, if you just wait till it's dry, it stops smelling.
Oh, like, No, you pick it up.
It doesn't.
No, it just changes.
I can help you. We sell pooper scoopers. Anyway, sorry.
So the flies were everywhere, right? They're on the peeling walls, the warped ceilings, and pieces of rotten garbage. No one was eager to look, but that was their job in that gruesome place. Then, at around 3:45 p.m., they turned up yet a third set of remains, wrapped in two sheets and buried under rags and other debris that had been beneath the second body they had discovered.
This is making even my coffee hard to digest. This is the apartment of death.
Now, this body was nearly skeletal, but the remains had shreds of clothing that might assist in identification. As they made room for this one to be photographed and removed, they started to toss broken pieces of furniture and piles of clothing through the window to the outside lawn. Less than 2 hours later, the searchers turned up a fourth set of mummified remains, also wrapped in sheets and buried under a pile of trash.
Wow.
Detective Hansen said to the reporters, quote, "This could be the first time, to my knowledge, that we've found four bodies of suspicious death in the same house."
And I gotta
tell you,
for an apartment, this is supposed to only have two occupants maximum.
Right.
This is way over.
Occupancy.
The murder, also breaking the lease. Is this an apartment or is it a house?
It's an apartment.
Okay.
Yeah. Higher ranking officers were called in to assess. Now, this was obviously going to be a long night. The place was small. Each room was about 10 by 12 feet, but it contained a lot of garbage.
Hmm.
The forensic team carefully searched through the debris, removing items piece by piece to ensure nothing was missed. Johnson had sent for the medical examiner, who didn't usually come to routine death calls, but this one was unfolding in a way that set it apart from the norm. The fifth body was found around 5:30 p.m., pulled out of another area of debris. But the weird detail about this one was that he or she, they really couldn't tell, had been sandwiched between two mattresses. And clearly, they had been there a very long time. The searchers actually wondered if the evicted tenant had actually slept on top of the mattress with the victim underneath.
Wow.
A storm rolled in and thunder cracked as the team went through the debris over the next several hours. The investigators brought in more lights and continued making their way through the disgusting contents of the rooms. It appeared as though the tenant had resided in one room and kept the adjoining room as his own private mausoleum of sorts.
Fucking weird private thing to have.
Right. In the front room, it seemed like he'd been preparing to actually build a new wall with building materials scattered all over. Another 2 hours went by before a sixth body was located, crammed inside a tiny six-inch deep closet.
Wow.
Sitting up, wrapped in a sheet and tied with white electrical cord.
I mean, some people collect baseball cards, but...
Yeah. Word spread quickly around the neighborhood as people asked about the crime scene tape. A hushed murmur rolled through the small crowd. They'd found bodies in there. 8 or 9 of them.
Judy was right. There were bodies.
Right.
Sorry.
So despite the rain, people came out of their houses to watch as more official vehicles pulled up. Empty body bags went in, and full ones were carried out by men in masks. Quote, "The curious crowded into the narrow block of North 19th Street in the steaming August heat to watch the grim parade of body bags," end quote, wrote Christopher Joseph Grace for the Philadelphia Daily News. One after another, less than an hour apart.
It's like a clown car, but an apartment.
Of death.
Okay, I know, right?
How many can they fit?
Jeez.
Christ, I thought my apartment was quite small, but apparently it's spacious.
Yeah, so this is it.
Wow, this feels like a pretty small place.
It seems small.
Like, really small.
Well, actually, my last tenant had 7 people in here.
There's no way 7 people lived in here.
I didn't say they were alive.
So 6 bodies were removed from the debris-strewn apartment and were sent off to the morgue for examination. There was little doubt that this was going to be yet another case of serial murder. Dusk was settling in, so the police used high-powered searchlights to go through the rest of the building just in case there were more bodies strewn about in other abandoned rooms. Eventually, they called off the search but resumed again at dawn the very next day. On the roof, they discovered a moldy canvas bag under a dirty mattress that contained a human leg and some foot bones.
Hmm.
Once again, the medical examiner came to have a look while one team made preparations to dig up the backyard where Graham allegedly had been digging at various times.
He's like, you know, I'm going to put everything in the yard, but I'm going to keep that foot.
Right.
I really like the foot. Have you seen this foot? His friends come over. He's like, I got to show you this foot.
I got a foot.
It's really nice. Look at it. Look at the little bone there, the foot, the ankle bone.
So,
wow, a foot.
They investigated the backyard where he'd been seen digging, as well as the lot across the street. Another team went to locate the missing tenant. What he'd have to say about this was anyone's guess.
He just kept showing me this foot. It was kind of peculiar.
Graham's photo, albeit a fuzzy rendition, was circulated citywide to police districts, to the highway patrol, and to special units. It was also placed in the next day's newspaper in the hope that someone would spot him and alert them. Patrol officers began making rounds and asking questions and found out his name was Harrison Graham, but people knew him as Marty. He'd lived in that building for more than 4 years.
I don't get the correlation between Harrison and Marty.
I don't either.
Maybe there's a middle name.
Maybe it's his middle name.
Yeah, Marty. Martin.
Born on August 9th, 1958, the eldest of five children, he was nearing 29 years old. He was about 6 feet tall with a medium brown complexion and an average build, but had really broad shoulders and giant hands. Many people knew him because he worked as a handyman around the neighborhood, and they considered him a quiet and friendly man.
With those big hands, being a handyman, it's fucking writing itself, those ads.
A high school dropout, he was known as a drug user and dealer, even providing a, quote, shooting gallery in his apartment for people who wanted to inject drugs to get high.
Entrepreneurial.
Detectives were told about a collection of Marty's composition notebooks, which a neighbor had seen in the apartment that allegedly featured crude sketches of naked women and dismembered body parts.
Mainly feet.
Including breasts, feet, heads, and male genitalia. Additionally, the same acquaintance had seen Marty dangle a woman named Renee out of his window.
Yeah.
Renee had screamed, and then he pulled her back in. An arrest warrant would soon be issued, charging Graham with, at the very least, several counts of abuse of a corpse. He was known to frequent three general areas: his building, 8th Street by Erie Avenue, and 56th and Spruce.
He was going to shoe stores. He loved
feet. Here, he had other friends and family. People who knew him offered police tips on where he'd been seen since his eviction, but those who followed up the leads were unable to apprehend him. Marty's mother, Lillian Graham Jadar, 45, was located, but she said she'd ask him to leave because of his drug habit. She did provide one bit of information, though. He told her several months earlier that his girlfriend Mary was pregnant. Then, on July 4th, he said the baby had died. Another woman named Robert DeShazer had lived with Graham in her home a few years earlier. She, too, was a drug addict, and they'd gone together to the third-floor apartment on North 19th Street. Lillian added that Marty'd been diagnosed with a mental disorder when he was 12 and had been hospitalized for 2 years.
Real quick, instead of showing ads where for anti-drug ads for the hard drugs, where it's like, this is your brain on drugs, or some of these things, they should just show a drug addict's house.
Hi, kids. Don't do drugs, because do you want this? Is this what you want? Look at that guy. You want that?
I want to bite my eyeball.
I don't. Don't do drugs.
That would be a good ad for me. I'd be like, oh, no.
Well, so Marty was also classified as learning disabled and had lived in a foster home for a while. The men who had evicted Marty were questioned at this time as well. Quote, he didn't say nothing when I told him to leave, end quote. Although he admitted that initially Graham would not let them inside. Quote, I heard him moving things around in there. I heard some banging noises like hammering, end quote. When he left, Graham took a water bottle, clothing, and a few bags. He was wearing white pants, a striped jacket, and a cap. And he had his raggedy blue Cookie Monster stuffed animal.
Cookie?
After gathering information from the neighborhood, investigators compiled a profile. They learn that Graham often took long walks and played basketball with local kids.
I like basketball and long walks, but I hate kids.
He liked to entertain them with his Cookie Monster voice.
Cookie.
Am I supposed to like this guy?
No, one neighbor said he was a loner, but when he got drunk, he'd act a little crazy, doing things like dancing in the middle of the street.
That sounds like 45% of my friend group.
Now, no one interviewed immediately after the discovery of the bodies reported aggression on Graham's part, but eventually, several women said that he tried to rape them or hit them over the head with objects.
Wow.
A drug user who wanted to remain anonymous told reporters that a person could get any kind of drugs in Marty's apartment. She'd assumed that the foul odor in there was due to toilets not working and the mountains of trash laying around.
Huh. Yeah.
And maybe even the dog poop.
Yeah. Oh, wow. I'll sit next to this on the couch without the poop. How about that?
So the landlord reported that he always paid his $90 a month rent.
Oh, those were the days.
And that his income of $300 a month came from Social Security disability funds. Whoever Marty was, he remained a mystery for the time being as he continued to elude the police. Now, Robert L. Catherman was the acting medical examiner who'd gone to North 19th Street to view the remains. News media had crowded near him to hear his comments, but he merely said that they knew nothing at the moment about the identity of the victims. They didn't even know whether some were male or female.
Oh, boy.
In the morgue, the bodies were put through painstaking procedures to try to identify them and determine the cause and manner of death. It was believed that the first two found, both black females, had been dead just 2 or 3 days, but due to the intense summer heat, they decomposed quickly. Hmm. Both were in their late 20s or 30s. One had been nude, the other partially clothed with a sweater pulled up over her head. Now, there were no obvious signs of violence, such as like a bullet or bludgeoning. The other bodies would take way more time and investigation. They weren't identifiable at all, even for race or sex. An anthropologist would need to assist by reading the bone structure. With the advanced state of decomposition, it was going to be difficult to determine a cause of death as well. Although, 2 days later, thanks to a broken hyoid bone, they managed to determine that the fourth victim found had been strangled. By August 11th, it was clear that the two most recent deaths had been murder by strangulation, which would make a total of 3. Then, the leg and foot bones from the canvas bag were also identified as being from a female. Autopsies on 2 more of the remains, what little could be done, confirmed that they'd been black women in their 20s, but determining the cause of death was going to be impossible. The medical examiner adjusted the time of death on the first two as having occurred within the past 10 days rather than 2 or 3. A woman had come to the scene after hearing about the House of Horrors on television because a friend of hers who lived in this building had been missing for several months. She was 30 years old, and her name was Sandra Garvin. This acquaintance believed that Sandra could be among the dead. Within a day of the discovery, 3 more women were suggested as potential victims. All had known Graham, and all were missing.
Oh, boy.
One woman who'd lived with Graham hadn't been seen for 2.5 years.
The math is checking out here, I think.
Right? Additionally, a man recognized the clothing from the second victim and believed that she was his wife. In the meantime, the police continued to look for the man who could clear up some of this mystery. The building on North 19th Street was officially condemned for several code violations, and those few tenants who were still there were ordered to leave. They were given temporary shelter by the Department of Health and Human Services. Thanks to the picture in the newspapers and to neighbors who knew that the police were searching for Graham, numerous sightings were reported.
And thusly, the Ghostbusters were called in to get rid of all the things that might be scaring folks.
On August 11th, he'd been seen on Broad Street on a SEPTA bus, at a soup kitchen, and at a car wash. Unfortunately, the police arrived too late in each instance to arrest him.
Slippery.
One person who saw him getting a meal at the church described him as having a glassy-eyed stare.
What kind of church, honey?
I'm not going to try and...
evangelistical?
It's just a Catholic church, and it was hard to say, so we removed it. So he was carrying a bucket full of rags and was dressed in white pants, a striped jacket, and a black cap. The police came in only moments later showing his picture, but were still unable to catch him. In the meantime, the crime scene team was going through piles of debris in the apartment and had found items that they believe might assist in victim identification. Three earrings and a ring were retrieved. Two earrings, one heart-shaped, had been next to the mummified remains of the third victim, and the ring and third earring had come off of another set of remains. The ring was crudely made, and the earrings had a grid design. The newspapers printed this information in the hope that relatives could identify the victims. Two women reported missing had been found alive, so they were removed from the list of potential victims and onto the list of potential witnesses. One of them had lived with Graham without issue. Another neighbor came forward to tell the police that she'd seen Graham beat Robin DeShazer, a dire warning that DeShazer could be among the dead. Local forensic dentist Haskell Assens came into the case to assist with identification via dental records. "We're looking for uniqueness that could be found in a single tooth," he told Philadelphia Inquirer reporters. Assens would also need to have the actual dental records of a suspected victim for comparison purposes, which meant that relatives who feared that a loved one was among the carnage had to produce those records. At the very least, he said, he could give an age estimate. Only one of the six full sets of remains recovered had not had dental work done. The excavation around the building did produce bones, but they turned out to be from dogs. And reports indicated that Graham had once owned three different dogs.
What, he was killing dogs too? Fuck this fucking guy.
No.
Killing people and dogs.
And he had buried them after they died.
Ah,
hopefully
okay.
They died of natural causes.
Well,
died of illness due to the complete filth house.
It's probably rude to him. I'm not giving him the benefit of the doubt.
So no more human bodies or body parts were recovered, although several blackened pieces of recovered bone were sent for analysis. Graham's family put out an appeal for him to turn himself in, although none of them believed that he'd actually killed the women. One younger brother told reporters, quote, "Marty was afraid to go to our grandma's funeral. He stayed outside. He didn't want to see the body. He was certain that Graham could not have been sleeping in the same room with corpses." On August 15th, 6 days after the initial discovery, there was another grisly find in the basement of a building 3 doors down from Graham's.
He's killing grizzlies to the sounds of 3 doors down? Sorry.
Oh my God, I totally lost my train of thought.
Sorry.
Okay, so 3 doors down from Graham's house, it was owned by a relative of the man who owned Graham's building. A human torso and skull wrapped in a brown blanket and tied with an electrical cord were found beneath debris. Now, this was similar to the way the body had been stored in Graham's closet, but this one had been partially buried under a mound of coal ashes. The task was now to determine if they were parts of the same victim as the leg bones.
This guy's got a, what, 700-square-foot apartment?
Yeah,
he's got, like, smelting plant in there,
fucking
embalming fucking...
What?
This is the area where we put the nose pieces.
Well, they were trying to figure out if this was the same victim as the leg bones or whether it was yet an eighth unidentified person.
Right.
The medical examiner office stated that six of the victims had been black females, and one had been identified, Mary Jeter, 36, the mother of 5 children. Now, while DNA analysis had been used in several forensic contexts that same year, it was not yet a common method for victim identification. Philadelphia Medical Examiner Office, just as investigators, were working on that project continuously. Now, the suspect, now the target of an intense manhunt, surrendered on August 17th. Marty Graham stood waiting on a North Philadelphia street corner while his mother directed the police there.
Cookie.
He'd asked her to bring him some food, she said. And she'd gone to him and persuaded him, right? Persuaded him to surrender to the police. Now, the police took him in for questioning and by evening had charged him with 7 counts of murder and 7 counts of abuse of a corpse. Due to the fact that his clothing was stained, they obtained warrants to have his pants and jacket tested. Now, according to Lillian Graham, her son claimed that the bodies had been in the building when he'd moved in, and he'd not killed anyone.
That doesn't explain
the recently dead two females.
Yeah. Well, I didn't want to. I'm against conflict, really.
I'm non-confrontational. Yeah. I don't want to tell anybody. I didn't want to be a complainer.
I'm a very agreeable person. It smelled bad, yeah, but I could get over it.
However, in custody under interrogation, he eventually confessed. At first, he'd said he'd only killed two, but then he admitted that he strangled all seven female victims while under the influence of drugs. He was full of remorse and told police, according to the Philadelphia Inquirer, that he wanted to straighten out his life.
Too late.
Right. Well, he offered the names of five of the victims. Graham's former girlfriend, Robin DeShazer, was among them. Another was Cynthia Brooks, who was 28, and the identified victim, Mary Jadar. Graham also indicated that he'd strangled Barbara Mahoney, 22, and Patricia Franklin, 24, some he'd lived with and others he'd lured with the promise of drugs. He hadn't known the names of two victims who he'd encountered in the street. One was Sandra Garvin, 33. Now, Graham's MO had been to get them with drugs and alcohol and then strangle them while having consensual sex. Afterward, he'd fall asleep and wake up to find the woman next to him dead. Now, the strange thing is it always surprised him. He indicated that they'd all been killed that year, beginning in January, although this would come into question. It was just something that started to happen, he commented, and once he started, he couldn't stop. The first time was with DeShazer. He hadn't known what to do with the body, so he just left it in the apartment. When he brought another woman up with him, he hid DeShazer's corpse by shoving it out onto the roof, reachable from his back window.
And she's like, Marty, it smells awful up here. And he's like, cookies? No.
He'd actually told another living girlfriend about it sometime later, and she'd seen it.
She smelled it from her apartment, too.
Well, she'd threatened to tell the police if he didn't move it. So he'd taken the head and torso to another building, but had left some of the remains behind in a bag.
The feet.
Right?
Look at these sweet feet. God.
Cookies and feet. Cookies and feet. Cookies and feet.
Well, the body had been left there. He told officers birds had come pecking, which had bothered him a bit. But he hadn't minded the maggots.
That's the opposite for you, huh?
Oh, God.
That's your, like, Achilles heel is maggots.
Now, during breaks, Graham would sketch the faces of women. The detectives were surprised to find that Graham was articulate. He was a talented artist and wasn't as they had assumed and wasn't illiterate. He apparently read the Bible avidly. In the end, the detectives had Graham's 10-page statement, which included details about each murder and his feelings about what he'd done. He insisted many times that he hadn't meant to kill anyone, and to him, the deaths were accidental. They were due to his sexual technique, he said.
Okie dokie.
He'd held them around the neck and had probably just pressed too hard. Graham was arraigned, dressed in pajamas and slippers, and held without bail while a preliminary hearing was set. At issue was his background of mental illness, which also raised questions about his competency.
Cookies?
To have waived his right to a lawyer and to have actually confessed. He received a public defender, Joel Smolsky, and went into solitary confinement at the city detention center. The two sides squared off in preparation for battle in court. Now, Molsky, who insisted that Graham should have been given a public defender right away, learned that he'd been handcuffed to a chair for 4 hours as he was interrogated, and that a public defender had been available in that building. Apparently, Graham hadn't realized that he could have just asked for that person's assistance. When this procedure was criticized by the press, by the city's public chief defender, Benjamin J. Lerner, Detective Hansen responded that Graham's mother had been present throughout the questioning. Around this time, the police teams finished their investigation and placed metal sheets over the open doorways and broken windows of the empty building. They also sealed Graham's former apartment. Now, clear of trash, there would be no more gruesome discoveries, but the legal battle was now heating up. The DA needed witnesses, and they soon arrived. On August 25th, the Daily News published an anonymous account by a former lover of Harrison Graham, who said that in January of 1986, Graham told her that he'd offed another girlfriend and tossed her out the window. She waited one day until he'd gone out and then went to the back window. On the roof was an old weathered mattress. So she went out, lifted it, and found a skeleton. She hadn't believed his story about murder before, but she did now.
Yeah.
Even with this discovery, she stayed with Graham. I don't know why.
Yeah.
Eventually, she informed the police and then moved in with her mother. But the police never located the body, which I don't know how. It's right outside the window under a mattress. But yeah. Anyways, when she learned about the bodies found in the apartment, she counted herself lucky. Quote, "I get nightmares and I can't sleep," she told reporters. "It's like his hands are around my throat and the life's going out of me," end quote. Eventually, she'd lose her anonymity, presenting her story in court. At a hearing on August 27th, Graham reportedly rocked back and forth as a detective read parts of his gruesome statement. According to one excerpt to a visitor to his apartment, he'd explained away the maggots as furball bugs.
No.
He called them furball bugs.
No, they're not furry.
No, they're not. To ignore the birds eating a body outside of his window, he'd had to stay high all the time. When the police finally came for him, he hadn't known what to do. The corpses of his most recent murders were in the front room, so he tossed them into the second room, boarded it up, and ran away. Clearly, the question of his competency to go on trial was at stake, and Joel Molsky ordered the testimonies of two psychiatrists. Dr. Robert Stanton indicated that Graham had an IQ of 63, below the level considered mentally competent.
And the other guy was like, and he loves cookies.
Well, and that Graham was a serious substance abuser of alcohol and drugs, and thus was unable to cooperate in his own defense. He suffered from auditory hallucinations and blackouts and was psychotic with chronic paranoid features.
Poor guy.
Psychologist Albert Levitt said that Graham was unable to read, write, or even tell time. Additionally, he was highly distractible. But Dr. Robert Sardoff, hired by the DA's office, declared that Graham had no significant mental impediment to assisting with his attorney.
Yeah, he said he was reading the Bible, I thought.
Mm-hmm. So, quote, "He was able to respond to my questions," Sardoff told the reporter. "He was able to give police a statement. It was coherent. It was logical." Judge Edward Meckel declared Graham competent to be prosecuted. 4 days later, Robin DeShazer's remains, found partly in a bag and partly in a basement, were formally identified through medical and dental records.
This guy had all sorts of places to stash shit.
Yeah. Okay. She had indeed been the first one to die, although in his confused state, Graham had described killing others before her. The time and cause of death for her could not be determined. Months later, on October 6, Graham pleaded not guilty to the charges against him. Judge Charles Durham asked him if he understood the proceedings, and Graham just said, nope.
Fair enough.
That was his answer. He banged his fingers on the bar, mumbled to himself, and swayed on his feet. He also claimed he didn't know where he was. Now, his attorneys reiterated that Graham was not competent to continue. Graham just said he wanted to go home. In January, another neurological report indicated that Graham was not suffering from organic brain damage. Nevertheless, Molsky, his defense attorney, prepared for an insanity defense scheduled for January 19, 1988. The single unidentified victim with the morgue tag 3760 was placed into the hands of forensic sculptor Frank Bender, who'd been asked to assist with the identification of this victim of Graham.
A forensic sculptor is a job you don't say that you want to be when you're growing up as a kid.
Well, this victim was the third one to be found. She had been a tall, thin, black woman, said the anthropologist, about 5'9", between 20 and 30, with a very narrow skull. She was found nearly skeletonized beneath the decomposing corpse of another woman. Jeez. At the time of her demise, she'd been wearing khaki slacks and two long-sleeve shirts, and the two earrings found next to her were presumed to be hers. Bender completely defleshed the skull and placed tiny rubber posts on it to guide him in adding about 5 pounds of clay for the right tissue depth. He then put fake eyeballs into the sockets. The elongated face made this victim more of an individual with a unique appearance, a pointed chin, and an asymmetrical nose aperture. Adding a new hairstyle that he believed was right for her, Bender had a photograph taken for the newspapers. Then authorities waited and hoped that someone would recognize her and come forward.
Imagine the person that wants to be a sculptor.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, I'm pretty good, but I'd be better if somebody just started the process first. And they're mm-hmm. like, can you work with bodies? Yes, I'm in. I can't.
Well, there's
a weird job.
There's individuals out there that have anthropological knowledge and a penchant for art, basically.
Yeah.
And they're able to look at objects and see what they once were.
I hope they get paid a fuckload.
Yeah.
I hope they
They're very important, I think. Well, now
I've seen some where they'll take, you know, Cro-Magnon man that they found, you know, mm-hmm. from 100,000 years ago or
right.
whatever, and they'll make it so it looks like just how they looked. Probably.
Well, after the last several decades, really, with technology advancement, the sculpting itself is now done digitally. So there's digital sculptors now.
So they're taking
instead
away.
Instead of
fucking AI just wants all the good jobs, all of them.
Okay, so back to the story. An older couple reported that their daughter had been missing for 6 months. They knew that she'd been an acquaintance of Graham's, and the description they gave was a match to the medical examiner's notes. Now, investigators got the young woman's medical records to compare against the remains. He also showed the family photos of the complete bust that was created, but they said they weren't sure. Yet others who had known the missing woman believed that the sculpture resembled her, and they recalled the earrings she'd worn that were just like those that were found next to the corpse. Mm. A past chest x-ray that showed an odd characteristic with one of the ribs finally sealed it on January 28, 1988. She was Valerie Jameson, 25 years old, the mother of two sons, and she disappeared in April the year before. With the victims identified and their association with Graham established, it was time to go to trial. On January 28, the pretrial hearings began. Graham was ruled competent to stand trial based on the reports of 5 court-appointed experts. They said that during his evaluation sessions, he'd been calm, friendly, and alert. He did show evidence of personality disorders, but he understood the legal proceedings well enough to participate. He seemed to understand that he potentially faced the death penalty, but believed that God was watching over him and, quote, lets me know he still loves me, end quote. He went to court with rosary beads tucked into his belt. Mm. Even the defense attorney's psychologist who had initially found him incompetent had changed his opinion. 2 of the experts indicated that Graham had been faking his disorganized state during his earlier hearing.
Hmm.
Now he was lucid and clear, thanks largely to antipsychotic medication.
I'm going to ask this to you, wife, knowing that you're mm-hmm. not going to have seen this movie, but there's a movie called Primal Fear. Mm-hmm. It's where we all met Edward Norton, and he mm-hmm. did that. He played a character that was where he just played with everyone that he was mentally mm. unfit, and then he was pretty brilliant at the end.
Huh.
Ever see it?
No, I've
Random
never seen it.
Shit. I know
I've
you
never
haven't.
Seen it.
I didn't need to.
Very interesting, though. Yeah. I may want to look into it.
Richard Gere is also in that film.
Huh.
Enjoy.
Well, in early February, there was a 2-hour hearing to determine which part of the prosecutor's evidence would be admitted. More than 100 gruesome photographs of the apartment were entered as exhibits. When Graham saw them, he waved them off as the deeds of a very sick person and then actually chuckled, although he added that it hurt his stomach to see them.
No cookies.
Judge Robert Latron ordered Malski to keep him quiet or he may, quote, bury himself just by opening his big mouth, end quote. Charles Johnson, the medical examiner investigator, offered testimony about his experience during the investigation, and he described how he'd found each of the 7 bodies. He posted the photographs as slides on poster boards, and the judge came down from the bench to examine each one. Journalists from the Daily News and the Inquirer were in attendance of the hearing, and Dave Rasher recorded Molsky saying that Graham was happy to have the press there because they would then hear how he'd been treated under interrogation. Supposedly, the police had beaten him and otherwise coerced him, which had provoked an involuntary confession. Now, the police, obviously, had denied these charges. Later during this hearing, Graham stood up and growled, "You're lying," at ADA Roger King, the assistant district attorney. Hmm. Deputies rushed to control him in the event that he showed evidence of aggression, and Graham's mother, present in the courtroom, just said, "Sit down and be quiet." Hmm. His comment apparently was in response to King, who muttered, "You should get a better defender." In fact, the entire trial would prove to be an antagonistic and even personal struggle between the two attorneys.
Huh, weird.
Molsky accused King of withholding a statement from his client made by a woman, Mary Hogan, who'd once lived with Graham. And King denied it, and then they argued over the case. The judge warned them both to cut down on the animosity.
What in the hell is wrong with you two?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. My colleague here is just a huge cunt.
Oh, no, no, no.
I need you two to stop acting like school children. You're lawyers, for Christ's sake.
Well, that doesn't mean like we're good people.
No.
Well,
in fact, it kind of leans towards the opposite of that.
We fuck people,
no,
hey?
No cussing. Order.
On February 17th, Molsky indicated that because the murder was inconsistent with Graham's peaceful personality, he clearly had been framed for the deaths of the seven women.
I just like cookies.
He's not a killer, Molsky said. He's a lover.
Of cookies.
What?
Yeah.
Graham had admitted to murder only after the police suggested it, because his mental age was that of an impressionable 9-year-old. It was possible that the women found in his apartment had died from overdoses or had been killed by others and dumped where they were discovered.
True.
A week later, Molsky tried again with another psychiatric expert, Dr. Timothy Michaels. The psychiatrist stated that Graham could not have comprehended his constitutional rights when he waived them at the time he made his incriminating statements. He was a heavy drug user and mentally defective in other ways, so he couldn't have known what he was doing when he confessed. ADA King insisted that the doctor's opinions were ludicrous. It was far too removed from the time of the police interrogation to render an accurate judgment of competence. At the time, the experts had already testified that they couldn't make a judgment in the matter. Homicide Sergeant John Finn brought evidence into the courtroom that had been seized from the abandoned building where Graham had hidden during the manhunt.
The world's oldest sport.
Among them, among these items was his Cookie Monster puppet, which he immediately asked to have back.
How about?
I sleep with that, he said, but the puppet remained in evidence.
Why?
The pretrial hearings ran for 14 days. Then Judge Latron suggested that he was inclined to throw out Graham's confession to four of the murders. When he'd initially been questioned, Graham had admitted to three. When he was questioned later by Detective Hansen, he added the rest, but Hansen had not reread him his rights as was required to do by the law. This made part of the confession precarious, but in the end, Latron allowed the entire statement into evidence along with the graphic photographs taken at the scene. He also decided to sequester the jury, and selection for the trial began on March 4th. Now, King announced that he would seek the death penalty. Joel Molsky had honed his defense in preparation for how he was going to fight for his client. It wasn't just insanity, he said. It was multiple personalities. Now, Harrison Frank Graham Jr., according to the Daily News...
He's also Kermit.
Yeah. According to the Daily News, Frank Graham Jr. was presented as having three distinct personalities. Frank was a foul-mouthed drug addict and murderer. Jr. was an unmanageable 2-year-old who adored the Cookie Monster. Uh-huh. And Marty was the likable handyman who worshipped his mother and had complied with the police to confess to the murders.
But really loved feet. Fuck, he loved them feet.
Graham had apparently fought with another inmate in prison and blamed it on Frank. Hmm. Now, King dismissed all of this by saying that Graham was just a streetwise faker. Graham's mother believed in his innocence. She said she never would have turned him in if she believed he would be convicted. It was her contention that he couldn't have purchased the blankets and sheets in which the bodies had been wrapped, so he didn't kill them. Someone else did.
Huh.
They were trying to frame him. On March 8th, Graham waived his right to a jury trial and chose to have the judge decide his case. Apparently, his attorney and his mother had convinced him that a jury would be offended by the graphic evidence and would be less objective than the judge. Okay. Latron had already heard much of the evidence, so the duration of the trial would be considerably shorter than expected. Right away, there was a surprise. A woman named Paula testified for the prosecution that she'd lived with Graham for 3 years, and during sex, he'd place his hands around her throat and squeeze. On several occasions, she thought he was killing her and said that he actually wanted to hurt her. He told her that he killed one of his former girlfriends, Robin DeShazer, because he'd been angry that she'd been seeing other men. Graham threatened Paula with the same treatment. She also said that he admitted to practicing necrophilia with the corpse.
That's not what we wanted to hear.
Well, this provoked an outburst from Graham, who accused her of lying. However, she continued talking about how he barricaded her into the apartment, threatening her with a machete, and sometimes raping her when she was in a stupor from drugs.
Jesus.
Paula also said that she'd visited Graham after she'd moved out and had smelled a foul stench from the room that they'd previously used as a bedroom. He told her it was from a bucket into which he urinated and warned her.
Oh, that's fine then.
Right? He warned her, don't ever look in that room because if she was ever there alone, because she wouldn't be able to deal with what she'd find. However, the fact that Graham had beaten Robin DeShazer to death rather than killing her by asphyxiation, coupled with the fact that Paula had survived her 3 years with him, helped the defense. In addition, this testimony added credibility to the possibility that Graham was unable to appreciate what he was doing. 2 days later, Mary Hogan also testified to having lived with him and survived. She said they'd have sex 4 or 5 times a day. He tried to strangle her as well, and she saw the body of Robin DeShazer on the roof. That meant the corpse had been there since before October 1986. In order to get out with all of her belongings, she had to seek assistance from the police because Graham had threatened to kill her with a machete and had shut her inside the apartment. Now, she did tell an officer about the corpse on the roof, but he didn't believe her. There was drama in the humid courtroom when Hogan said she'd never loved Graham and had never been pregnant as he thought she was. At this testimony, he grabbed the witness table, jumped up, and shoved aside 2 deputies. He wanted them to leave him alone, but apparently he disliked the idea that he'd been duped and was highly aggressive. When a drug addict companion of Graham's took the stand, he described watching Graham trying to choke 2 women during altercations. Both were among the dead, and one was killed shortly after the man had seen the argument. He also said that Graham had admitted to murdering the other women, and he'd even seen Mary Mattis lying on the bed when Graham had invited him in to see the source of the terrible odor.
Plus he had
coming from his apartment.
He had that t-shirt, too, that said, I killed these people.
But this witness's statements were set aside when it was learned that he'd been found incompetent to be sentenced for his own crimes that he'd been paid for his testimony.
Okay.
Bummer.
Yeah.
After 4 weeks, the ADA rested his case, though.
Paid by whom? Shit.
Right. Then it was Molsky's turn. The first witness on Graham's behalf was his former foster mother. Wilhelmina Williams had taken care of him from the ages of 2 to 7, and she said that he'd been a slow learner. He was essentially incapable of taking care of himself. She'd never seen him learn to read or write. Graham's biological mother supported this when she said that her son never seemed to learn anything. Unlike her other children, he failed to grasp the difference between right and wrong. He was also a troublemaker in school and suffered from nightmares. Another psychiatrist also testified on the issue of insanity. Dr. Timothy Michael said that since Graham couldn't recall anything about the first 5 murders, it wasn't possible to judge his mental state at the time of those crimes. However, during the last 2 murders, which were still fresh when he was arrested, he'd been in a psychotic state. He'd hallucinated the voices of both God and the devil.
Oh, good.
When cross-examined about Graham's apparent awareness that the a discovery of the body on the roof meant he'd be arrested, Michael said he couldn't address those crimes. He admitted that if Graham's statement to the police hadn't been forced, as Graham had claimed, then clearly he'd known what he was doing was wrong.
Hmm.
That would make him sane at the time of those crimes. Concealing the corpses indicated that as well. When they discussed the leg bones found in the bag in court,
Lafitte.
Graham actually began to giggle.
Oh, boy.
Yikes. In his closing argument on April 22nd, Malski offered some options. The women found in the apartment may have died from drug overdoses, or other people, such as the landlord or relatives, may have tampered with the scene. After all, they found the bodies. Malski also restated his position on the insanity defense and insisted that his client had been on drugs and may have strangled the women by accident. ADA King declared these statements to be sheer fantasy and urged Judge Latron to consider only the reality of the evidence. No one, he pointed out, could believe that someone could accidentally strangle seven women. Graham, plain and simple, was a serial killer. George Latron found Graham guilty on all counts of first-degree murder and abuse of a corpse. As Latron spoke, Graham sat up straight, blinked his eyes, and shook his head. Now, Malski later told reporters, quote, "I assume he knows he was found guilty, but I'm really not sure," end quote. He then prepared to keep Graham from being executed during the sentencing phase. Despite the evidence, Graham's mother still insisted that he was innocent throughout the entire case. Judge Latron did not look at the defendant when he sentenced Graham to six consecutive sentences of 7 to 14 years, six death sentences, and one life term.
They could just say a death sentence. They could just say, we're going to leave you in here until you're dead.
But this is interesting. Yet, in an unusual move,
We've got 47 50-year sentences. Eat that. Oh, 48.
Sorry.
Yet, in an unusual move, he added that Graham was not to be executed until after he served the life sentence. Interesting. Molsky found this ruling to be compassionate.
What? That's like, hey, we're going to spend 50 grand a year on the guy.
Well, in essence, it meant that Graham had received a life sentence without the possibility of parole.
Which they could have just said. They could have just said that.
Right. Yeah. But this gets interesting. So Latron said that Graham's terrible neglect during childhood, along with no prior criminal convictions, had been mitigating factors. The single life sentence was for DeShazer's murder, by the way. However, no one foresaw what would happen in prison. In Pittsburgh, Graham studied religion and would become ordained. He seemed happy, but then in 1994, a law clerk for the state Supreme Court submitted the case for routine review, and several officials called the sentence illegal.
Really?
In a unanimous ruling, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said that the death sentence must be carried out, which put Graham in immediate jeopardy of being executed. The execution was scheduled for December 7th, but Latron stated the U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear the case, so the date was reset for August 1996. Other delays pushed the case into the year 2002, when the U.S. Supreme Court banned the execution of the mentally disabled. Finally, on December 20th, 2003, some 17 years after his initial sentencing, Marty Graham was deemed incompetent to be executed. His death sentence was vacated and his life sentence restored. Now he continues to practice as a minister in prison.
Huh.
And that's our story.
Well, fuck, I got some questions for you on the other side of the thingy.
I bet you do.
Okay.
And now it's time for this week's conclusion of the Dipshit Files.
Thank you, Mrs. Scriptkeeper, for all of that research.
You're welcome.
Presenting that story. I've never heard of that guy.
Yep.
That's fucking gross details.
Yeah.
But I don't even know if it's hard to say if he did or not.
Well,
it sounds like he did to me. I'm pretty compelled.
That's just it. After digging through all of this research and just kind of looking into it, I'm kind of on the fence.
Where do you lean?
I think he did it.
Okay.
I do. I mean, it's just obvious. He's living with dead people. He did it. The thing that I'm on the fence about is if he was mentally competent or not, for one. And two, was he a serial killer?
That's, I guess there's a technical definition that
right. Yeah. I mean, he wasn't seeking out victims. Was he? Maybe he was. Was right. he seeking out victims that followed a specific pattern? I mean, his killing technique was the same. But right. then again, you know, everybody is... It's really difficult. It's hard to explain.
Yeah.
Really, because, I mean, he's just killing people while having sex.
Yeah.
The problem is he liked to strangle people, I guess. So autoerotic asphyxiation mm-hmm. was his thing, I guess.
To other people.
To other people, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. I'm not sure.
Well, what possibly makes him seem innocent? Just the...
Well,
not,
the fact
not innocent,
that,
but just that he can't process things.
Well, that and he had girlfriends he didn't kill. He did the same thing to them and they lived.
Right. So did H.H. Holmes and, you know what I mean?
Right.
They all had people too.
So there's that where I kind of lean towards he killed them, but maybe it was an accident.
Right.
Maybe it was unintentional. However, the testimony where he threatened to kill people kind of throws that
yeah.
on its face too. So I'm not sure. I think he was mentally not there.
Right. And I don't think human beings are mentally there when we tell people we're going to give you 19 life sentences.
Right.
17 non-life sentences on top of that for 6 years apiece.
Yeah.
You do the math, motherfucker, no matter what. Even if you're a biblical character, you won't make it out of prison.
And death. And you're sentenced to death. It was a very interesting case to me.
Yeah, it seems like it.
Because this was happening all the while. We had Burdella. We have the... I forget the others. This was all happening in the same city at the same time
yeah.
as all of this other shit.
Okay.
I mean, it's almost like Pittsburgh kind of lost its shit for a while.
And Philly?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the 80s and 90s were amongst the most violent times,
mm-hmm.
certainly in modern history.
Yeah.
Crime rates have gone down from there,
mm-hmm.
where they were at the peak in like 92. But the 80s, crack was a mm-hmm. terrible thing for this country and anybody that had it. Okay. Well,
crazy.
What do you guys think?
Yeah, what do you think?
Is he innocent? Is he... Well...
He's obviously... I don't think he was innocent.
No.
He was living with dead people.
Yeah.
And he was trying to dispose of the bodies. But...
And he loved their feet.
Was he out to kill? Or was it an accident?
Yeah.
I guess is the big thing. Additionally, with the evidence that I've provided, because I've just scratched the surface on the evidence of his mental... state and his psychological disorders, with the evidence that I have presented, do you think that he was competent to stand trial? And do you think he was coerced, like they said?
Is there footage of him at all?
I couldn't find any, no.
Yeah.
There's pictures of him, though.
Be better to see him act and see how, I mean, mm-hmm. it'd be tough to,
I mean,
to
there's,
go by.
There's a couple news footage videos of him walking, but that's it.
Okay. Well, thank you for presenting this mm-hmm. story. This is our last one of the season.
Yep.
But we take short breaks. We'll be back in 3 weeks.
Yes, we
back
will.
Back in May mm-hmm. 8th. By that time, we'll have motherfucking coffee in our hands and we'll
yes.
be shipping them out to you guys.
Yeah.
So we're excited for Scat Roast and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We're excited for season 4
yep.
of the Dipshit Files, all sorts of crazy shit. We've been getting lots of emails from you guys about mm-hmm. what you want to see next season and
yes.
what you've liked this season, all that good stuff. So you can send us emails.
Yes, you can to dipshitfilespod@gmail.com.
That's
dipshitfilespod@gmail.com.
That's right. And we have a bonus for all our patrons. We'll be doing, what mm-hmm. are we doing in the bonus this time?
We're doing, it's an aspect of the Bermuda Triangle. It's an mystery. It's an
right.
unsolved thing.
Well, that's right, but it's not the Bermuda Triangle.
No,
it?
It's
somewhere else.
It's on a totally different continent.
Well, fucking A.
Yeah.
So $5 gets you the Dipshit Files bonus every week.
Yes.
And this is the last one for a little bit there, too,
mm-hmm.
but we'll be back again.
Mm-hmm.
And as always, we'll talk at you in the future.
And it'll seem like the present.
Thank you, Trusted.
Dipshit Files.
Bing,
bing bong shitties.